They will be mostly sunny, and there's a 20% chance of showers and thunderstorms this afternoon, the high reaching 83 degrees. Tonight, partly cloudy with a low of 62. Monday, mostly sunny skies, a high of 85. Monday night, mostly cloudy with a low of 65. And Tuesday, partly sunny with a 40% chance of rain and a high of 85. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD2 and HD3 Urbana.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, July 26, 2009, here at WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Our guest today, U.S. Representative Jan Schakowsky, the congresswoman for the 9th District of Illinois, joining us to talk about what's going on in Congress, health care, war and peace, intelligence, a whole range of issues she's expert in. Should be a lively hour. Please join us if you will. Before we get to Representative Schakowsky, though, let's first go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
The Bay State Banner has been reporting stories for the black community in Boston for 44 years. But the Free Weekly had to stop publishing this month due to financial woes. The Banner has a reputation of holding city officials accountable to the public on a variety of issues, including development in poor neighborhoods and hiring more black police officers. Recognizing the value of a black-owned community newspaper, Harvard University law professor Charles J. Ogletree is putting together a group of investors to try to keep the paper alive. And Boston Mayor Thomas Menino offered the Banner a $200,000 loan that would be funded by a private nonprofit, Boston Local Development Corp. Banner publisher Mel Miller has accepted the offer. Victor Picard, senior research fellow at Free Press, cautions that the plight of the Bay State Banner is another example of a systemic crisis facing journalism around the country.
The Banner's case suggests it's more evidence for how advertising no longer adequately supports the kind of journalism that our democracy requires, and that we're dealing with the effects of a kind of market failure here. So when we're talking about this being a systemic crisis, we have to understand that this is a problem for public policy if the market is not supporting journalism.
One-time bailouts aren't going to be helpful to this systemic failure in the long run. Picard instead suggests changing tax laws to allow struggling news organizations to become low-profit, limited-liability companies, or L3Cs.
L3C is a hybrid that would allow both private investments and charitable contributions while mandating public service to local communities. It would be an ideal approach to struggling news organizations, especially small newspapers.
Some have criticized Menino's loan offer, saying the money could compromise the Bay State Banner's impartiality during an election year. Picard says we should always be watchful when large amounts of money are given to media organizations, but
we should also point out that the influence from advertisers that fund commercial media and the corporations that often own these commercial media is no less problematic. And so really a better scenario would be to have more permanent funds devoted to public media that are beyond the reach of politics as well as market pressures.
In 2007, Verizon approached the Massachusetts legislature with a mission: to change the laws that govern how cable companies negotiate with cities and towns to offer video services. Similar so-called statewide franchising laws were enacted in more than a dozen states over the past few years as telephone companies looked for ways to break into the pay TV business. But after Massachusetts Public Access Television activists turned out hundreds of concerned residents at a public hearing on the bill, the legislation never came to a vote. 2 years later, Verizon is back with a new bill, and public access advocates are once again turning up the heat. A public hearing was held at the State House on July 22nd. Colin Rhine-Smith of Cambridge Community Television, an award-winning public access center, attended the hearing. Rhine-Smith explains Verizon's new bill would change the laws over local franchise negotiations in ways that could harm community media.
The current system that's been in place for the past 30 years works, and we believe that this legislation could have a real negative impact on cities and towns across Massachusetts. And in particular, we're most concerned about the threat to the cable franchising process, which would limit the negotiation period to 90 days, which would essentially make meaningful negotiations impossible.
Many of the people who testified at this week's public hearing said the negotiation process was lengthy and complex, even for cities and towns with significant resources. 90 days, they said, would not provide municipalities enough time to truly assess the needs of their communities. They were particularly concerned for smaller rural towns, which rely on volunteers to negotiate these contracts.
I think what we saw yesterday at the hearing was overwhelming opposition to the legislation. There was a packed house with public access supporters, local officials from across the state. There was a single message that this bill is bad for local communities.
To find out more about Cambridge Community Television and the Massachusetts bill, go to cctvcambridge.org.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today on WILL AM 580. Our guest today holds among her many accomplishments being a graduate of the University of Illinois back a few years ago.
Oh, just a couple.
Already piping up. We can't keep a politician off the mic for long. Our guest today is Representative Jan Schakowsky from the 9th District of Illinois. He's been in Congress for the past 10 years. You're in your sixth term now. Before that, a long stint in the Illinois General Assembly. And before that, much work as a consumer advocate for the people of Illinois. Jan Schakowsky, welcome to Media Matters.
Thank you so much, Bob, for having me.
You know, what I'd like to do on the show, if you don't mind to start, is what I've discovered over the years from talking to my listeners and my students, for that matter, is that the civics education isn't super high in this country. And a lot of people really don't even know how Congress works, especially well, even people who follow the news pretty closely. And I noticed that one of your many job duties is deputy whip. And maybe for starters, what is a deputy whip?
Well, the WHIP organization, first of all, there is a WHIP as one of the elected officers within the caucus. We have the speaker, the majority leader, the WHIP, the caucus chair, and the vice chair. Those are elected by the members of our caucus.
Meaning the Democrats in the House.
That's right. And then job of the WHIP and the WHIP organization is essentially to get the members of the caucus to find out where our votes are, and then to work to persuade everybody to vote the position that the caucus has taken. Now, we don't take positions on every bill, that's for sure. But for the important pieces of legislation, like the energy bill, for example, first we needed to know who's voting yes, who's voting no, who's undecided, what do they need to know, what information can we get to them. And then at the very end, if we absolutely need their votes to pass a bill, then we figure out what it is that's really going to change their mind. It may mean the speaker has to talk to them. It may mean the president needs to make a phone call. So the WHIP organization gathers the votes.
And you're the deputy WHIP. Who's the sheriff WHIP?
That would be Jim Clyburn from South Carolina.
Mm-hmm. Now, I would imagine then, if I follow the news properly, you're going to be fairly busy, as will your Senate counterpart with any health care legislation, whipping maybe some recalcitrant members of the party?
Well, I would. That's absolutely true. But the problem is with the healthcare legislation is that we don't yet have a caucus position. We don't really have yet an agreement among the Democrats of, you know, where we're going to end up. It's really been very, very difficult. This has been, since I've been in Congress, certainly the most important legislation that we've dealt with, but also the most difficult in terms of getting a consensus.
Now, Jan Schakowsky, you're a member of several committees, and you chair the subcommittee of you're the chair of the subcommittee, the House Permanent Select Committee, and the Intelligence Subcommittee and Oversight Investigations. You know, the committee system, I think, is confusing to a lot of people who aren't experts in civics and law. What role do committees play, and how important are they, and how Congress works?
Well, if we there's something called regular order. So a bill gets introduced, it gets assigned to a committee, or perhaps more than one. For example, the health legislation is done primarily in terms of the substance in my committee called Energy and Commerce, which has a very broad jurisdiction in terms of the issues we deal with. But when it comes to how are we going to pay for the bill, that issue goes to the Ways and Means Committee. And there are a number of things that deal with the Education and Labor Committee. So the healthcare bill goes to three committees, hold hearings on the issues that are within their jurisdiction, and pass out a bill which, at the end of the day, gets put together. The whole House votes on it, and it's sent to the Senate. Sometimes when either there is some sort of urgency about passing a bill or that we just can't get a consensus in a particular committee, a bill sometimes goes right to the floor, without going through the regular order of going through committee. So the committees, but that's generally not the best way to go, and so we try and do it through the committee structure.
Our guest today on Media Matters, who you've just been listening to, is U.S. Representative Jan Schakowsky, Congresswoman for the 9th District of Illinois. Jan Schakowsky is on with us live today, and we thank her for joining us. If you'd like to call in with a question or comments for the representative, the telephone number here at WILL-AM 580 is 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. And I'm finishing our civics lesson, if we can,
okay.
Jan. And I've done this with other members, too.
Yeah, I don't mind at all.
It's the whole issue of lobbyists and money. We hear, you know, constantly the important role lobbying plays and how much money there is that influences legislation. And I think recently, for example, there's been some publicity, although not a great deal, about how the stunning coincidence that some of the Democratic members of the House and especially the Senate that I've been following who are opposed to health care reform have coincidentally had enormous contributions from the health care industry to their campaigns.
Isn't that a coincidence?
Yeah, just a stunning coincidence, I know, but just a fluke.
Remarkable.
I mean, how important is money? Are the cynics right that money basically buys policy in Washington?
You know, I really wish with all my heart I could say no. And perhaps in some circumstances there's a no there. But I want to tell you, for example, it just happens that the Blue Dog Caucus, which is the Blue Dogs, that's a group of the more conservative Democrats in the House, and they generally represent kind of more rural conservative areas in the country, but they are, you know, really negotiating hard against many aspects of the health care bill that we have right now. Their PAC has received about $1.1 million in recent days, a good deal of it from the healthcare industry. And you know, what you want is that when members of Congress in the House start reaching toward the electronic voting machine that we have, you want to think that they're thinking about you if you're a constituent. What's really important to you? Sort of ordinary folks in the district that are going to vote for them. But there's just no doubt about it that, you know, given the necessity right now of raising a lot of money in order to run, that all too often people are thinking about their donors, who's contributed to their campaign. And I think it really is a spoiler for the process. I am a huge believer that we have to have campaign finance reform, and by that I mean we got to get the money, the private money out and its influence out.
So you mean publicly funded elections?
Yeah.
Representative Schakowsky, in this sort of money that comes in, is the effect simply that it gives you money to get reelected? Is there any way that sometimes with some members this money ends up in their own bank accounts or the bank accounts of members of their family, either directly or indirectly? Because if it's just to get elected, that doesn't seem to be enough.
It's illegal, period, if it gets into their bank accounts. And I have to say, I think it is not primarily about personal gain, except to the extent that getting reelected is about personal gain. No, I don't think so. Every once in a while, we'll certainly have a scandal where mm-hmm. the money has made its way there. But I think mainly it's the argument that I have to get reelected and have to raise that money. And you know what? The other thing, Paul Simon, who was our great senator from Illinois, talked about it when he retired. And one of the ways he talked about it was, we get a lot of phone calls, and at the end of the day, you're going to have a lot of messages stacked up. And you look through the messages as a member of Congress, and you see a big donor has called. And on the other hand, you see somebody you're not really sure, it's a constituent, but you're not so sure about whose phone call is going to get returned. Mm-hmm. And he was being really candid about that. It's a question of access and who you're really thinking about. And so the money, even in the best of circumstances, with the most ethical of members of Congress, he was admitting, becomes a problem.
Jan Schakowsky, I guess. This is one last closing point here. But how are the ethics laws on things like if you're a member of Congress and your son or daughter gets hired by some lobbying firm, and clearly their primary attribute is their relation to their parent. Is that prohibited by law?
It is not.
So there are those sort of benefits.
Because
I've noticed a significant number of relatives who seem to be on the payrolls of these lobbying firms.
Yeah, no, that is absolutely true. And you can make the case that there are subtle and not so subtle ways in which it can be personally beneficial to the family. Yeah.
Our guest today, Jan Schakowsky, the U.S. representative in Illinois from the 9th District, equipped us to talk on a number of issues we plan to get to today, including the war in Iraq, the intelligence crisis or scandals that are going on in Washington right now, and also consumer protection and voting rights, two issues that have been near and dear to her heart throughout her career. The phone number here again at WILLAM580-333-9455, toll free 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines now to a couple of callers who have been waiting patiently. First, line 4, Spring Bay, you're on the air with Representative Jan Schakowsky.
Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. I think you're just the person I wanted to talk to if you're in a leadership position, because I'm starting to get a really bad feeling about the way this health reform thing is going to be playing out. My question would be this. I had dinner 4th of July with some Canadians, and I asked them specifically whether they like their health care system, and they love it. And yet I hear these arguments, these anecdotes about, well, some woman had a problem and all of that. And so I asked them, I said, is it ever an issue in your political campaigns in Canada? No, it's never an issue, they said. People seem to be very, pleased with it. If you think about all the European countries who have this nationalized health care, it does not seem to be a political issue. Candidates don't seem to run for it or against it. It just seems to be part of life. And why isn't the Democratic leadership making this argument, whipping these blue dogs into place, getting out over the break here and blanketing the country with some offensive arguments rather than playing defense on this and pushing this thing through? And I'll hang up and listen. Thanks, Bob.
Well, thank you very much, caller. And Jan Schakowsky, before you answer, let me just add on a PS to that or an addendum. You know, I recall when President Obama was a candidate early in his campaign, before the primaries, he once or twice in speeches said that if we were starting from scratch, we would obviously go with the single-payer system. It's the most rational way to run a healthcare system. But we can't do that because the health insurance companies are so huge and the pharmaceutical industry is so huge, their political muscle prohibits that option for the United States. So that's why he isn't in favor of it. And he dropped that, I think, after someone told him, or he figured out that wasn't really a smart way to present the issue. But it is still the rational question. Was he right then?
Well, let me. I think so. I prefer a single payer system right now. And in fact, those of us who have agreed to a public option say over and over again to our blue dog friends that we see that as a compromise already. That we've already made concessions to accept the notion of a one public option for people to take. On the other hand, we also say to people who are adamantly just a single payer that you can have your single payer. You can go to a public option. Of course, you know, there's still efforts going on to get rid of it. But let me talk about Canada.
Okay.
For a minute, because I think it's really the point that the caller made is really important. There is not even the most conservative members of a parliament in other countries and all the other countries that have a universal health care system, a public health care system, that would dare to say, "Oh, let's get rid of ours and go the direction of the United States of America." Everybody around the world knows that despite some Republicans who continue to want to say we have the best health care in the world, that, you know, that they would never say, let's get rid of our system. And I think he's right that it just isn't an issue. Talk about a third rail of politics. They're smarter than that. They know that they better not talk about getting rid of that system. So, and the thing about Canada, when I went to look at their healthcare system, I went to Toronto, which is a city that any American, especially from Chicago, would recognize. They look like us, they talk like us, and they have the same diseases that we do. And it really struck me that not one of those people is worrying. They're worrying about how to take care of their cancer or their diabetes or their HIV or AIDS or their child with a disability. But not a single one of them is trying to figure out how the heck am I going to pay for this? Am I actually going to get the care that I need? What a huge burden we have the opportunity right now to lift off the shoulders of Americans, and that anyone would be resistant to that is just so frustrating to me. Yeah, we could argue about the details, but when it gets down to it, it's not about the details. There are particularly the Republicans who want to just kill it. The name of their program is Status Quo, where not only millions of people are without any health care at all, but more than that are without real access to health care because of their lousy health insurance.
Jan Schakowsky, are you worried that if some version of President Obama's plan does get through and get approved, so there's a public option, but the health insurance companies and the status quo firms are still alive and well and kicking, that it's going to be very difficult to have a very strong, viable public option that won't constantly be at warfare to survive with powerful interests trying to make it very unattractive?
The reason I don't is because if we do it right, and I have to tell you, it's still in question, so I want to encourage your listeners to keep it up, calling and keep those cards and letters coming to Congress, that it's going to be a better deal, that people are going to choose it because the premiums will be lower. It'll just be a better buy from them with exactly the same benefits as are included in the private plans that are in this what we're creating as an exchange, a whole list of various insurance private and the one public insurance plan that they can pick from. So I really don't worry that much about it, and that's exactly why the health insurance companies are worried about it, is because they think it is a better deal.
Our guest today, U.S. Representative Jan Schakowsky, joining us on the phone. Let's go back to our phone lines here at Media Matters. Let's go now to line one. Champagne, you're on the air with Representative Schakowsky.
Yes, good morning. Good afternoon. I totally agree with you in every way. I have two questions, one about long-term, about electing people to the House every 4 years instead of every 2 years. But I'm going to let that one sit because this is more important. When you talk about the Blue Dogs having received $1 million-plus from various health care concerns, I wonder if you could specifically name them. I hear Obama on the TV say that the American Medical Association is being cooperative in the new bill, and that even the pharmaceuticals and the hospital associations are being interested in seeing a bill from Congress that does a universal health care. So who are these organizations in particular, and should we be lobbying them and not just our Congress people?
Thank you very much, caller. Representative Schakowsky?
Well, I think certainly we're talking about insurance companies. We're talking about some doctor groups. Let's remember that the AMA now represents only about 40% of doctors, so not all doctors are, when we talk about, there's some specialists, I think, who see themselves as being losers in the new plan. So various of the groups, I'm sure there's some hospitals that are giving because they worry about it. So it's a variety of representatives of the healthcare industry, many of whom have their own PACs and don't represent the overall support that we're finding from some of the parts. But as far as targeting sort of the strategy of targeting the groups, I think certainly part of our message is that it's the health insurance industry, number one, that is fighting this. And it's good to name CEOs of the companies and the amount of money that they get in the message. So if by that you mean targeting, writing letters to the editor and talking about how much they earn and benefit from the kind of non-system that we have right now, then I certainly would agree with you, I think. And then everybody also needs to target the decision makers, the members of the Congress, urging even the progressives to stay strong and to target those who are against the bill to vote for it. It's just hard for me to quite understand the political advantage of being against health insurance reform in this country. And so we have to make sure that we change the calculation for these members, that the dangerous vote will be to vote against reform.
You know, Representative Schakowsky, much of the news coverage from my experience, at least the television news coverage, which I've watched in the past couple of months, of the Blue Dogs has really downplayed the amount of money they're getting and the influence of the healthcare industry and the insurance companies, and played up the idea that they come from more conservative districts, red districts, so to speak, and that their constituents, their voting base is unsympathetic to healthcare reform. Is there any great evidence that this is the case?
You know, that's the thing that is puzzling to me. I have this fabulous progressive district, and so what one of the things they like to do is to discredit the credibility of someone not from one of their districts when it comes to speaking out about, you know, this. Well, you know, I just don't understand. In fact, let's see, we were told the other day, you know, look, I couldn't win in your district and you couldn't win in my district. That's probably true. But what I don't understand is when it comes to health care reform, having access to affordable health care, why in any way that would be different. In fact, a woman who gave to me the most dramatic testimony in this whole debate was from Joe Barton's district. He's the ranking member on the Energy and Commerce Committee, a Republican opposed to this plan. And he was there as he listened to this woman, Robin, 59 years old, who was a nurse for 30 years, had health insurance, was in good health, retired, started her own small business, and finally found a health care Blue Cross Blue Shield plan that she could afford. And then she was diagnosed with a very aggressive form of breast cancer. And the Friday before the Monday that she was supposed to go in the hospital, Blue Cross called her and said, wait a minute, we're doing a five-year review of your medical records. Here's the, to make a longish story short, they ended up canceling, rescinding her health insurance back to the day when she had signed up for it because they said that there were mistakes. No, there was evidence in her record that she really had a pre-existing condition. What it was is that she had acne, which was, they wrote down, might be some skin thing on her face, might be precancerous, had nothing to do with breast cancer. For 7 months, this woman tried to get someone to do the surgery or tried to get Blue Cross to do it. Finally, Joe Barton was the one that got Blue Cross to do the surgery, by which time the tumor had doubled in size, had gone into her lymph nodes, and her prognosis is way, way worse. She's from a very red district. She has a member of Congress who's a leader in opposing this bill. So I don't get it. Why would Joe Barton be against it? Why would any member of Congress be against providing, guaranteeing healthcare, ending pre-existing conditions in their district?
Our guest today, U.S. Representative Jan Schakowsky, you've just been listening to. Jan Schakowsky represents the 9th District in the northern suburbs of Chicago. Do you have part of Chicago, too, in your district?
I have an equal number.
Half Chicago, half Evanston and suburbs.
Yeah.
Folks who want to call in here to Media Matters to speak with her, 333-9455, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phone lines now to another patient caller. Line 2, Champaign County, you're on the air with Jan Schakowsky.
Hi. Great opportunity, and I have a myriad of things, so I'll try and fine-tune it. But the Center for Public Integrity, I believe started by your friend Charles Lewis, has the report on the Blue Dogs, and on the Sunday Funnies this morning, there was at least an acknowledgement that that the Blue Dogs may not just be deficit hawks. I think it was one of the comics said that they're blue from the blue states and they're called dogs because they roll over for the healthcare industry. So,
okay, good.
So there at least was their mention on nationwide television. Not much of one though. I wanted to ask you about in this regard the Senator Simon, I think, should be invoked quite a bit. After all, Obama took his seat and went to the presidency through it. At the time of the Health America Act, which was actually the full name of the Clinton bill, he put out a bill called Improvements to the Health America Act. I think he got to give one speech on it on the Senate floor, and I've been looking for that a little bit, actually. But one of the things it included is this single-payer option for states. Now, I don't advocate that as the best way to get to single-payer, but it seems a reasonable prospect. And Dennis Kucinich has actually gotten a bill through
right.
Health and Labor.
Right.
I'm wondering whether you're on that committee and whether you voted for it and whether you can say some things about it. I did have some international issues. I've always liked your stance against military contractors in Colombia and everywhere. And I'm worried about the defense authorization amendments that are apparently there's a lot of things being played with that. And I also wanted to ask you about Honduras, but I'll let you go on the health care issue, if you will. And I appreciate any follow-up I might have or not.
Thank you very much, caller. Representative Schakowsky?
Okay. Well, so wait, let me get the essence of your health care question again.
Oh, I think we might have lost him.
Let's okay, go ahead.
To keep the lines open, we ask caller.
I know it was a Kucinich bill. I'm not on the committee, and I would certainly support it on the floor of the House, giving states the option of doing a single payer system. I think would be a great idea. Now, having said that, let me just tell you that the Education and Labor Committee probably would vote in general for a single payer system. I mean, it's a pretty progressive group of people on that committee. But even so, I would say that we certainly ought to have a full discussion of that. I would support it, and I think it's perfectly reasonable. This is a state's rights issue. Let them do what they want. We'll see how far that gets to go. But the other thing is, as far as the deficit hawk thing, that's what I don't understand. One of the concessions that we made when we talk about this this public plan, we want to link it to the network of Medicare providers. The Blue Dogs wanted an opt-out, that is, that doctors can decide to opt out. When that happened, we lost $91 billion in savings, according to the Congressional Budget Office. Now, they, instead of saying that the reimbursement to providers under the public plan has to be linked to the Medicare rate, Medicare plus 5. The Blue Dogs are saying, oh, no, our hospitals will have to close if that's the case. And rather, it should be between Medicare plus 5% and the average of the private health insurance company reimbursements. Now we're back to tying it to private rates. And with that, we lose another $75 billion, according to the Congressional Budget Office, in savings. So I'm not sure where the, being deficit hawks really comes in, or being budget hawks trying to, reduce costs overall comes in. I don't see it.
The point you just made, Representative Schakowsky, is this, it's your experience in following the issue, is this being covered well in the news media? Are these points being elevated so people understand what's going on?
I certainly don't think so. But it's also, I think even the politics of it, I don't think is being covered, much less the sort of the economics and the details of the plan. I don't know. Maybe I'm underestimating the American people, but this big push for I just saw an ad saying, ask your congressman if they've read the bill, the 1,100 page bill, saying that if they haven't read it, then they shouldn't be voting on it and we shouldn't pass it. But, so the whole effort to delay to delay this thing, as if we haven't for decades been discussing reform of our healthcare system, as if something is going to happen magically over the recess if people read the bill, that they don't know enough about it and there's going to be some revelation. The whole idea is to kill it.
Yeah, I mean, I've never heard that criteria applied to a defense appropriations bill.
Certainly not.
Or to a bailout of the banks. I mean,
certainly
then it's like,
not.
Don't read it, skip it.
Certainly not.
Well, Representative Schakowsky, we've got three callers waiting patiently, and I'm going to get to all of them. But before we do, I want to make sure we talk before the program's over about your work on the Intelligence Committee and the revelations that the CIA has been for the past many years engaged in activities that should have been notifying Congress of and had not been notifying Congress of. Where does this stand right now, and what are you doing about it?
Okay, well, as chair of the Oversight and Investigation Subcommittee of the House Intelligence Committee, we are at this very moment beginning our investigation. We're collecting documents and figuring out who we want to come and testify about this. Not only was the Congress not informed about a program after 9/11, this was all the way back to 2001, a program that's been in existence until June of 2009, when finally Leon Panetta, the new head of the CIA, was told about it, and he instantly ended it. But what we know is now that Dick Cheney himself, the vice president, quite self-consciously and deliberately ordered that Congress not be told about it. The National Security Act is very clear, although they'll probably say that there is this loophole, which there is, in extreme circumstances, and for a short period of time, that the president might make a decision not to tell the Congress. It's reflective of what I felt over, I've only been on the committee for 2.5 years, a contempt for the Congress that I felt was exhibited in many different ways over the last 2 years of the Bush administration, that somehow it was just this big annoyance to have to deal with us in the first place, to even have to answer our questions. And there was never an effort to be forthcoming. If you didn't ask, even the Republican members call it 20 questions, exactly in the right way. If you don't ask the question, you don't get an answer. This is a very dangerous situation because this is the intelligence community is by definition operating in secret. And if there is no oversight by the Congress of the United States, which was a huge issue in the 70s by the Church Commission, then, you know, you've got people running around doing things that could blow back on the United States in a very negative way.
You know, Representative Schakowsky, it seems that from where I'm sitting, and I may be wrong, correct me if I am, that the Obama administration is rather unenthusiastic about applying the rule of law to the Bush-Cheney administration, or at least people very far up the food chain, including Bush and Cheney. If, in fact, there is evidence that Bush and Cheney have broken the law, shouldn't they be prosecuted like anyone else would be if they broke the law?
And you know, I don't feel that what the president has said, and believe me, I mean, I was one of the national co-chairs of his campaign. I am a great friend personally of Barack Obama, and I've known him since he was in the state legislature here in Illinois, and, you know, always been a supporter. But I don't think what he has said necessarily has to apply to the Congress of the United States. And I choose rather to focus on what he said, that, you know, if the law has been broken, then no one should be above the law. But we're not just looking at the issue of laws that have been broken. We have to examine these situations to see if laws have to be changed in order to make sure that we hold people accountable, not just in the past, but in the future. And if we don't examine these issues, how will we be competent to make those kinds of decisions? I feel obligated in our role as an oversight body, that we have to understand what has happened in order to make sure it doesn't happen in the future.
Our guest today on Media Matters, who you've just been listening to, is U.S. Representative Jan Schakowsky from Illinois' 9th District. Schakowsky, also a graduate of the University of Illinois. She's joining us today on the phone. We're taking phone calls, and we have three callers who have been waiting very patiently. I'm going to get to them straight away here. Let's first go to line one, Champaign. You're on the air with Representative Jan Schakowsky.
Yes. I hope you will come back to this show, Representative Schakowsky, because I think the whole intelligence question needs to have more time. So I hope that you will be invited back so that we can specifically focus on that. I would like to find out who these Blue Dog members are, and are there any from Illinois? And is there a blog somewhere where we can find out who these people are? And I will tell you my comment, which is, it seems to me that for many legislators, and this is across the board, you know, from the city council, you know, up to the Senate and the House, that people are more concerned about getting reelected, making sure their pensions, which are good pensions, are not going to slip away because they're not elected. And so I'm just thinking, would it be better, at least in the House, to have every four-year elections instead of every two-year? And that would mean perhaps less fast money needed by these Congress people.
Now, thank you very much, caller. Representative Schakowsky?
Yeah. Again, I maybe it's because it's easy for me to say because I have a district that is considered a pretty safe district. And frankly, some of the Blue Dogs, after being elected several times, have, you know, win with wide margins as well and aren't as vulnerable, I think, sometimes as they claim. But I think there is something wise that the founding fathers, which I could say mothers too, did by having elections every 2 years. Essentially, you are campaigning all the time, and I understand what you're saying, that maybe that's not such a good thing because then we're always having to raise money. On the other hand, what you find is people are very connected to their districts. They need to go home a lot. They need to pay very close attention to what is going on at home. And so I, for one, would be reluctant to say to create a longer term. And of course, it gives the voters a chance every 2 years if somebody has really gone wild made serious mistakes to get rid of them sooner. Otherwise, you're stuck for too long.
Let's go to our next caller for Representative Schakowsky now. Let's go to line four, Champaign. You're on the air.
Oh, okay, that's me. I actually had a question. I'm a student at University of Illinois, and my sister just graduated from medical school. And the people that she graduated with and their families who are doctors and people I know who are going to medical school are usually staunchly supportive of Republicans who want to keep this healthcare system that we have now in place because they actually make more money per year and are told less often what to do by the government. Is there any way that people who are coming out of medical school who have $100,000, $200,000 in debt would be sort of forgiven of that debt if the new system, if they were going to be working for the government?
Yeah. Well, first of all, there's a number of mistakes that you've said. Nobody's going to be working for the government in the proposed plan. No more than doctors who right now take Medicare patients are working for the government. I also just want to say that the National Student Medical Association has been very supportive of the legislation. And one of the reasons is another issue that you mentioned. that they don't have to take orders from government. No, and our plan won't do that, but right now many doctors find themselves essentially taking orders from insurance companies. In other words, you have to get pre-approval for many things, and doctors find that insurance companies are threatening not to cover a whole bunch of things that a doctor may prescribe as medically necessary. Doctors are today are often having to look over their shoulder and find an insurance company there saying, uh-uh, we're not going to cover that. We're not going to pay for it. And actually sometimes rewarding doctors who have, if they're part of an HMO, who because they have less claims, they do less, and sometimes that's a good thing, but you know, that they reduce the amount of care that they give, they may even get a bonus. Obviously, we don't want overutilization, just doing a procedure for no reason, but we certainly want people to get the care they want. Under this current system, you know, we have the nightmare often of people just not being able to get what they need. We want to help doctors pay for their medical school so they're not burdened, one, with these high loan paybacks, and two, find themselves seeking out specialties like cosmetic surgery or something that pay really well because of the remuneration that they're going to get. And frankly, I think most people that go into healthcare want to be healers. They actually want to do good. So we're going to reward people that are going to go to underserved areas to take care of people that really need care because they haven't been getting it. So we want to reverse the incentives in the system, help doctors and students to become doctors, and help them to do preventive care and do more practice family medicine. And so, yes, we're going to do all of those things to make it easier for doctors.
Let's go to another call right now. Our next call on line 3, Champaign, you're on the air with Representative Jan Schakowsky.
Yes, hello. Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call. I have two comments/questions. The first one is about preventive care. I find that with, you know, switching insurers as you move from job to job, there seems really little incentive for the insurance companies to provide preventive care. And I was wondering, and to me it seems there is much less preventive care done here if I look at my coworkers and fellow students than in my home country of Germany, where to some extent future co-payments are tied to proving that you have done preventive care. So you're insured in case a non-preventable catastrophe happens, but in case, you know, it's just you slacking off, then you're on the hook for it. So there hasn't been much discussion about that. The second thing I've been wondering about is kind of a systemic risk here. We've just seen that if your neighbor takes out a bad loan, that can really hurt your house value. And to me, something similar is going on in Medicare. If my neighbor's kids are not insured, if he is not insured, then that's a health risk to me. If my kid's teacher has to worry about, you know, making medical payments, then that will affect her teaching and my kids. So this interaction aspect of everyone around me being insured and not having to worry about their health is, to me, seems really missing from the debate, and I think it's a really important aspect. Thank you.
I really appreciate all the points you made. I hadn't heard about the incentives for individual consumers that are and patients in other countries like Germany. That's a very interesting point, that you have some responsibility in there to take care of your own health, and then if something catastrophic happens as a result of your failure, then you're gonna pay a bit more. That's an interesting way to look at it. We are, in our health legislation, putting more of an emphasis on management of chronic care, of preventive care in the way of screenings and regular doctor visits, and also wellness, public health, making sure that we deal, you know, working to deal with obesity, with smoking, with those kinds of things, and putting resources into that. The other interesting point was that, of course, you're a health risk if your next door neighbor doesn't have insurance, or your children are in school next to somebody who didn't have insurance, and the kids are sick, which is also an interesting argument when it comes to immigrants. That is, people who are undocumented will not be covered by any plan. You know, what about the kids in school? Because we do let them to go to school. But there's one point that you didn't mention. We all pay for the uninsured. We pay for it in cost shifting to our own plans. So, you know, it's very expensive to the whole system to have tens of millions of people who are uninsured, because they do end up in the emergency room. So from every aspect, from health outcomes to the cost, it is a system that isn't working to have so many people uninsured and underinsured, and we're less healthy. You know, Germany is, I don't know how far ahead of us, but quite far ahead of us when it comes to health outcomes.
Well, we have time for one final caller, Representative Schakowsky, and it comes from your hometown, Line 4, Chicago. You're on the air with Jan Schakowsky.
Our kind of town, but I want to bring up the matter of funding, and an area that has not been explored is a tax on Internet transactions, specifically in the financial sector. They certainly reap the profits and glory of the making everything they have, but they haven't appropriately done their job in terms of carrying their share of responsibility and offshore banking and all the other kind of things that have been going on. So this is an area for funding that ought to be more explored, specifically on the financial transactions that take place on Internet. I think it would be something that you would be rewarded for if we could get something going on that. Thank you.
Well, thank you, caller. Representative Schakowsky, taxing financial transactions online or otherwise?
Yeah. Well, I'm not against. Talking off the top of my head, since that is not my area of expertise, looking for other areas where we can tax, and potentially certainly in the financial sector, that may be a way to go. But I have to tell you that any time, it's really perhaps not surprising at all, but talking about any tax, the estate tax, talk about a tax that hardly affects anybody except for the Paris Hiltons of the world, and it is hard to talk about getting rid of it. And, you know, that's another huge frustration that I have. Here we have, you know, the myth that it's a death tax and that everybody ends up paying it is just absolutely ridiculous. So I think we do need to look for more reasonable sources of income, and the caller's suggestions are among those that should be considered.
Well, Representative Schakowsky, I want to thank you so much for taking an hour from your valuable time to join us today in Media Matters.
It went so fast.
It did indeed, and I think we've already had a couple of callers suggest to make you a return visitor. We will have to do that down the road. If people want to follow your work, what website should they go to?
Well, they can go to, you know what, Google me.
Just Google Jan Schakowsky.
You'll find a couple of places where you can find me.
I've Googled you, and it'll be the very first thing that shows up is to click to your webpage.
Okay, great.
Thank you very much, Representative Schakowsky. This is Bob McChesney. I want to thank Kyle Kroha and Andrew Boyle for their usual great work as engineer and producer, and I'll be back in 167 hours. Everyone have a great week.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events, lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
In the weather forecast for Champaign-Urbana, today will be mostly sunny, and there's a 20% chance of showers and thunderstorms this afternoon, the high reaching 83 degrees. Tonight, partly cloudy with a low of 62. Monday, mostly sunny skies, a high of 85. Monday night, mostly cloudy with a low of 65. And Tuesday, partly sunny with a 40% chance of rain and a high of 85. This is